So I completely stink at holding a microphone and talking loud, two things that I need to do tonight. So if you can't hear me, if I suddenly get really quiet, just give me some kind of a signal so I know to correct that. So today we're continuing the series. Over the summer, we've been sort of looking closer at these Old Testament stories that are sometimes troubling, sometimes weird, hard to understand. And we're continuing that today. I'm going to be talking about the conquest narratives, a really, really violent thread of scripture. And if you caught, Josie's told a story from the conquest narratives, and if you know that story, you know that he had to nuance that story quite a bit to tell it to kids so they wouldn't be terrified and have nightmares. But I'm going to pray before I start, because this is really difficult material, and I've got a little fear and trembling about approaching it. So, God, I just pray, above all else, that you would be revealing your true heart today. And if we harbor any pictures of you that are less beautiful than what you've revealed to us through your Son, I pray that you would use this time to root out those pictures and really so that we could all sort of walk away with pictures in our mind that draw us to you and that perfectly reflect who you really are. Amen. So I'm going to be reading. Oh, what happened? This jumped like way, way ahead. Nope. Is that the second slide? It is? Oh, we've got an issue then. Okay. Whoa. That is. Yeah. So I'm going to be reading Joshua 6, if it's there at all. And what I want you to do while I'm reading this story is to, I think what I can do to get to it, yeah, is to sort of hold these questions in your mind. So I want you to listen to it as though you were there. Enter in as best you can. And I want you to ask yourself the questions as you're doing that, as you're experiencing it. What stands out to you? What questions do you have? And what feelings come up as you listen to this story? So the Joshua story isn't in these slides. Oh, it is. Okay, cool. So I'm going to start reading. And this is all of Joshua 6. So again, just enter in as best you can. Now the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one went in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the army will go up, everyone straight in." So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and have 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it." And he ordered the army, "Advance, march around the city with an armed guard going ahead of the Ark of the Lord." When Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the Ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priest who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. All this time, the trumpets were sounding, but Joshua had commanded the army, "Do not give a war cry. Do not raise your voices. Do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout. Then shout." So he had the ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the army returned to camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. I'm going to skip ahead because you heard relevant parts of this story. So they get up, on the 7th day, they do this shout, and then This is a curious part. He says, but keep away from the devoted things so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into the treasury. When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So everyone charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the prostitute's house and bring her out and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath to her. So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother, her brothers and sisters, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. But they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies into Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. At that time, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, cursed before the Lord is the one who undertakes to rebuild this city. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest, he will set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land. So I really want to know, as I read that and as you entered in, what stands out to you about that story? What questions do you have? Is there anything that's troubling to you in this story? And what do you feel as you hear this story?
I'm uncomfortable.
You're uncomfortable? Why?
God giving commands to slaughter innocent people.
Okay. So if you couldn't hear him, he was uncomfortable because of the sort of the wholesale nature of this slaughter. But everybody was killed. Anybody else? So at the end, when he curses, says, "Hey, don't! If you try and rebuild the city, your children are gonna pay for that. Your children are gonna die." That's pretty troubling. Anybody else? Anything else? Yeah, so the fact that he got famous for this, right? What else? Yeah, you guys have hit the things that were troubling to me. You pretty much covered them. The thing that I was troubled again by the innocent children and all the people who were killed. I was also troubled by this passage about the money, like calling the money the holy things, but people are slaughtered. That was really troubling to me. I had the question of why the elaborate and miraculous taking of this city without sort of normal means, and then killing people. That made no sense to me. Josias noticed that threat at the end. If you try to rebuild the city, your kids will die. And really, all of this is offered up as proof of divine sanction. The Lord was with Joshua. All that is troubling to me. I guess I want to say things like this are supposed to be troubling. Like, I think that's part of the point. And I think a lot of Christians read these passages and try to sort of push down the cognitive dissonance that comes with that. But I don't think we're supposed to do that. So I'm going to introduce you to a concept called, I think it's pronounced harem, but I couldn't find any authority to give me that for sure. What this means is the destruction of an entire people group, so genocide, as an act of devotion to God. And there are 37 different places where something like that is repeated, where God is, there's sort of a divine portrait of God either commanding or participating in this sort of a thing where he says, don't let anything breathe. And in those texts, a lot of times, there's an explicit command to show no mercy, to kill every living thing. Don't leave anything alive. In fact, there's an incident in the conquest narrative where they take hostages and they are punished for that. That's considered unfaithful. And in that portion that I just read out of Joshua 6 where it says they devoted the city to God, that's a reference to human sacrifice. So this whole incident was considered a giant human sacrifice to God. Yeah, that's troubling. Now, apart from the obvious problem of the picture of God that this brings up for us, can you think of other reasons why this might be problematic that this is contained in our scripture? I think that this has fueled a lot of violence. And it's kind of interesting that today is the day that we're talking about this. Because groups like the Nazis and the KKK, they consider themselves Christian organizations. And they sort of look back at things like this as a way of understanding how God deals with people that they consider that he considers outsiders. And so this has fueled a lot of violence. So we've got a lot of problems coming from these kinds of scriptures. It's easy for us to sort of point fingers and feel all clean about it, even though the KKK is an American thing. But really, we have our own history in this country, right, of using this. Do you guys know what manifest destiny is? Manifest destiny is this idea that we are destined to be in this land. It was given to us by God, which sounds real familiar, right? And so this is something that a man named Professor L. Daniel Hawk put together, where he's sort of examining the connection between the book of Joshua and the American national mythology. So he's like drawing all these parallels where with both of those things, God as founder of a nation and the divine warrior who fights for it. The conviction of this sort of specialness and set apartness from other people. This union via a common covenant and the contingency of national well-being on devotion and duty. Those all sound very American, don't they? And then he quoted this, I found this quote really fascinating. The Puritans saw themselves as the new Israel and read their immigration into the new world in light of the Exodus, God delivering his people from oppression by a passage through water to the new Canaan. These motifs were taken up and transformed in the revolutionary era by the founding fathers who needed a centralizing genealogy to unite these colonies into a single nation. So they used the Bible, they used these conquest narratives, and saw themselves in that story and used it as a rationale for what they were doing. Now, I also, as I was preparing for this, thought of Pastor Jeffries and what he said about Trump. You know, we've got this escalation with nuclear weapons, sort of the specter of nuclear weapons, and he said, in the case of North Korea, God has given Trump authority to take out Kim Jong-un. That's pretty troubling, because he's giving divine sanction to the specter of nuclear war and wiping out millions of people. Now, despite what you may or may not think about how governments should respond to things like this, it's really wrong and dangerous to assume divine sanction in this way. Now, as I said, the problem with these texts isn't just what we've done with them, it's the picture of God that they imply, okay? And so there's this sort of internal tension. So we need to resolve a couple of things. We need to resolve the tension and contradiction between Hesed, which is God's covenantal love and kindness. This is a theme that runs throughout the Old Testament. This idea that God is loving and kind and cares for us. And that's a thread that runs throughout the Old Testament. But we have to look at the internal consistency of the idea of Hesed in the same text where Harem is noted. Okay, so how do we... That's a problem. We have to resolve that tension. We have to figure out what that means. And also, even more significantly, how do we reconcile the divine portrait of the crucified Christ, who gave his life for his enemies, with the divine portrait of a bloodthirsty and merciless God who orders the slaughter of whole people groups? That's a big problem. And it's not just that we have to figure out how does this work, but we have to figure out in the Old Testament, how does this point to Jesus? And how do you do that? In order to do this, I'm going to tell you for the rest of my time a story of a faith crisis that I had. I think I've had them periodically throughout my adult life, but I had a particularly awful one about 7 years ago, and it was after I started reading the Old Testament and I came across this passage. I kind of said, I'm done. I'm done. If this is what God does, I don't know how to understand this. So in Ezekiel 7 through 13, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he's basically decreeing judgment on Israel. And down towards the middle, he says, I will punish you like I have never punished anyone before or ever will again. Does that sound like Trump to you? I don't know, something about that. And then he says, parents will eat their own children, and children will eat their parents. I will punish you and scatter to the winds the few who survive. He goes on and on. And then at this highlight part, he says, after all these terrible things happen, then at last my anger will be spent, and I will be satisfied. And when my fury against them has subsided, all Israel will know that I, the Lord, have spoken to them in my jealous anger. I read these scriptures, and I remember thinking, I'm done. I don't know what to do with this. So I guess what I want to do is to contrast this a little bit with Jesus and then give you things that were helpful to me when I went through this, okay? I want you to contrast this with, so everything I've been reading, with Jesus who said, forgive 70 times 7, which basically means keep on forgiving, don't ever stop forgiving. Love your enemies so that you can be called the children of the Father. Pray for those who persecute you. Blessed are the merciful and the peacemaker. It goes on and on and on. This is what God looked like when he revealed himself to us. And I think this is the key to beginning to sit with these. It won't necessarily solve your problem. But I think if we can keep our eyes on this and realize that there's got to be something else. This is the thing that you have to keep in mind. There's got to be something else going on. Because when God is fully revealed, this is what he looks like. Okay. I'll just have to go with this. So, like I said, I'm going to just kind of take you through what helped me. What really was helpful to me, and this actually went back to when I was in college. I had one of these sort of faith crises. And Greg Boyd introduced me to this idea of concentric circles model of faith. And what it basically means is we have really good historical reasons to believe that Jesus was an actual person and that some of these things... a good deal of these things actually happen. And if you're interested in this, Greg has written a book. There's tons of books that have been written about that. But because of that, we have sort of this solid ground to stand on, to believe that Jesus is who he said he was, and that this is what God looks like. And you sort of hang on to that as the center, and everything that goes out from that is less and less urgent. Now, I used to belong to a church where everything was just as important as everything else, and he calls that the house of cards model of faith, where if you take out one thing, everything falls apart. And that makes you really vulnerable. So I think this is a good model of faith, where if we can just hold on to something really tightly in the center and sort of relax a little bit about the questions that arise in these centers further and further out, or these circles further and further out from the center. So that's one thing that was really helpful for me. Another thing is this relational model of inspiration, that when we talk about the God-breathed nature of the Bible, that what it can't mean, is that God sort of dictated every word in the Bible. He breathes, he influences, he's a relational God, and his revelation is he breathes this revelation progressively through human authors, and in the process, their limitations, their beliefs bleed into the text. That's helpful for me. And I guess I want to pause here and say, anything I say from here on out, I want to really stress, you get to disagree with me. I'm sharing what's helpful for me. And Greg Boyd is going to be coming, not next week, but the week after, to lay this out more fully. So I'm just giving you little snippets of stuff. But I want to stress, you get to work this out in some other way and disagree with me on this stuff. In fact, I don't agree with everything Greg says in his books, so there you go. So he sort of thinks about these kinds of passages that I've been talking about as literary, he calls them literary crucifixes. So he's saying when a divine portrait does not conform to the image of the cruciform God, when it's that different, you know, those images really can't be reconciled. But when you've got these sort of divine portraits that look like that, what he wants to suggest is that it's God humbly stooping to take on the appearance of a guilty criminal in the way, just in the same way that he did when he was hanging on the cross. So if you just look at the cross, the surface information you're getting is that this is a guilty criminal who did something wrong and deserves to die. But when you look underneath, when you find the deeper meaning, that's not at all the case. And so he calls those kinds of texts literary crucifixes, and I find that personally helpful. Now, what I want to do with the rest of the time is just sort of settle into, think of that picture of a sort of this bloodthirsty, vengeful God who causes parents to do these terrible things to their children and wipes out whole, contrast that with, if we can sort of settle into the idea that Jesus is what God looks like. He came to us as a human child in this vulnerable way and grew as a human child. He dignified outcasts with the woman at the well. He wasn't supposed to be speaking to a Samaritan woman. He not only spoke to her, but he gave her these precious things and didn't judge her. He fed hungry people in miraculous ways. So he cared about our physical needs. He healed the sick that came to him. That was a big part of his ministry. He was a healer. He wept with his friends. So when Lazarus died and he came, he wept. He had compassion. He felt the same kind of grief that Mary and Martha felt. He was merciful to sinners that others were ready to kill. When he was with the woman who had committed adultery and they all wanted to stone her, he saved her and was merciful to her. He resurrected Jairus' daughter from the dead. So instead of murdering children, you have him raising them from the dead. And lastly, he died for us. And I think however you want to solve the problem of this dichotomy between what we find in the conquest narratives and other violent divine portraits in the Old Testament, I want to encourage you to stay really deeply grounded in when God came to us, when he wanted to give us a revelation that was really, really clear. This is what it looked like.